reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Call the second case for this morning, 001425, In Re the Commitment of State v. Burris. Mr. Summers, arguing on behalf of Mr. Burris. You may proceed, counsel. Okay. You're aware, of course, that there's some connection between this case and the last case we're going to hear today. Morford?
Yes.
And that Mr. Weinstein is arguing both cases for the state. We'll try and remember to keep these cases separate, but I always have some doubts that we're successful. Mr. Summers.
Okay. If it pleases the court, Attorney Joseph Summers on behalf of Irvin Burris. Your Honors, today, I was actually trying to think of how to get started because this case actually is, this is not the first time actually that this case is really before this court. It's different people, but the same issue had arisen before. And as this court knows, at that time the vote was 3-3. But as I was preparing, I was taking a look at the handout that was prepared by this court for people today that were going to come in and hear this argument. And what has struck me is this is exactly why this case has to be heard. If one was to go to that, it actually points out the fact that, or it actually points out an alleged fact that Irvin Burris has a history of 30 serious sexual offenses. First of all, that's not even true, and it's not even remotely true. And why that's important is this. That was actually a thing that was thrown out in the proceedings by his PO when he was attempting to poison all these witnesses to think that Irvin Burris was a danger. What's important for this court to understand is you would have thought, though, because, see, this is not a criminal case, that what would have been pointed out isn't the fact that he has this so-called history of all these offenses, but what would have been pointed out is the fact that he is supposedly mentally ill. And they would have then listed what he has. What is his illness? What are his treatment needs? That is supposed to be the very thing that is going on in Chapter 980 cases. When this court held them all to be, or held Chapter 980 to be constitutional, this court said that the reason why is because that this statute, we are going to take the statute at its word that it is for treatment, number one, and number two, that this treatment will be done in the least restrictive setting. And in the case at hand, what do we have? And then, of course, in the printout, it also points out that the appellate court said that it was irrational for the trial court to have considered alternatives to being locked up because he had already made a determination that Mr. Burris was a danger. But though, what actually happened?
Counsel.
Yeah.
The documents that you're referring to are distributed, but not by the court itself.
No, I understand.
You understand that. So
yeah.
You're using this as a vehicle for your argument.
Yeah, right. And what I'm pointing out, though, is...
I understand that, too.
All right.
Now,
what?
You're looking at the facts, right?
Actually, what I'm trying to get to is the facts behind the fiction. We have a fiction going on. And actually, and this printout actually shows that we have a fiction going on. It basically is that the whole fiction, and this case actually brings this whole thing right to a head, is that we are saying that basically we're here because we really care about treatment. We care because we want to make sure these guys get treated, so on, they are mentally ill, so on and so on. What this case actually shows is that's not so, and that's not what took place in this case. In this case, when the supervised release was revoked, the judge made the point to say basically is that almost to the fact that I had given this guy a break, and I thought he had the strongest incentive to follow every rule, dot every I, cross every T. And then because he didn't do that, then he went into this whole thing where he, the judge, himself, five different times right after that, he referred to his history. He said his history of this, his history of that, his history of this, his history of that, his history of that. And that's what it was all about. It was punitive from the very get-go.
Well, counsel, are we to assume that you're arguing the facts now? Now, on the law, and I note in the red brief that there's some distinguishing of cases that the state is saying that Morrissey and the Gannon case and others do not speak for that. But on the facts, and you seem to be saying that Judge Wilker did not consider the fairness aspect, the due process of your client. Now, when I look through the facts in this case, which you seem to be arguing, it seemed to me at least, and I'm not going to cite all of them, but it seemed to me that there were a number of rules that were set out in writing, and there were a number of instances in which your client, at least in the judge's perspective, as far as looking at those, violated or did not adequately adhere to those rules, basically not telling the secrecy, the obfuscation of some of the things that he did. And now you're referring to those that the judge either did, he overlooked them, or you're talking about what his past criminal history may have been. Is that what you're trying to distinguish here?
Yes. When he did that, basically, is he went into the history, not of how he has acted on supervised release. He went into his history way before he was ever convicted. That's what he was going into. He was going into his history of his crimes. And he never actually, that there was never at any point in time, there was no point in time that the judge ever tried to look at the situation and say, okay, let's say he has violated these three rules. And that is all that you are talking about, yes, in this case. He never said, okay, what can we do to make sure, let's say, that he's in a situation where, let's say, they can take care of it, they can have a little bit better control.
Counsel, and that seems to be bringing as a nexus to what's the issue in this case. And how would you, maybe what you think he should have done, how would you state the issue in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue in this case, I think it comes down to the crux. Is it really true that treatment is the goal of Chapter 980? And is it really true that they have to do this treatment in the least restrictive setting? That's what it's all about. That no one's even talking about it. No one ever talked about it.
Let me, if I can, and I understand your point, and that point has been made in some concurrences and dissents as well as in majority opinions, that this is a treatment and it's a civil commitment, etc. Let me state what I see are the issues, and then you can tell me whether they're not the issues or what your position is on the issues. First is, as I would put it at the moment, I think the issue is what rules were violated here. And it seems to me one of your major points, although there's a dispute between you and the state as to whether you even made the point, is that rule number one is vague. I refer to that as the standard on becoming a sexual offender standard. Then you've got, as the other rules, and they're on page 2 and 3 of the state's brief, that you inform the agent of activities and he didn't inform, and that you inform the agent of an intimate relationship, 18, and the argument is he didn't inform of the intimate relationship with the woman, and the 15A, he consumed alcohol. So on your first one, on rule 1, you say it's vague. On your others, you you indicate that it's not an intimate relationship because it's one time and he didn't have to inform, if I understood your argument, that you weren't given notice on possession of alcohol or consuming it, and he passed all of the random tests, if I understand your argument on that. And I don't know that I can remember and repeat at the moment your arguments as to why he did not give the agent the doctor's name and allow the agent to explore the use in getting the prescription of Viagra, right?
Yes.
That's the Bob Dole defense.
Okay. Well, now, I don't know about that.
That's the first one, and it's a due process vagueness issue, at least as to Rule 1. On the others, it's evidentiary and notice.
Yes, but, Your Honor, I guess actually my argument goes, it's actually even bigger than all that. And actually, it actually goes to the dissent in Kettig. I think actually I think this Court has to keep in mind that the entire setup for this case was unfair. It was a kangaroo thing from the beginning.
That's a due process, sir.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. But even for all these so-called, you know, rules that he violated, he's put into a halfway house. Basically, he's being revoked as much as anything else is because he's a live, breathing human being. That's what you're really talking about. We're like really talking about there isn't any single person who would be put into a halfway house and you have him there for 5 to 6 months that he's not going to have a few rule violations.
Okay. Now that leads to another issue, which is what violation of these rules required that he be placed back into for lack of a better word at the moment, warehousing in the institutionalized is the better word. It's neutral. Institutionalized. Now, so the question here then goes to, as I see it, which may not be correct, that's why I'm pushing you on this, then it goes to the State's argument, as I understand it, and I'm not sure the State's always consistent in its argument. The State's argument is that the Court found that he was a safety threat and that because he was a safety threat and the State proved that he was a safety threat, the Court has no discretion but has to reinstitutionalize himself. That's the way I understand the State's argument. I understand your argument to be, and this is question to you, that one, the State didn't prove it. And my question to you is, did the State ever allege that he was a safety threat?
No. Actually, what I think took place is that the Court threw that out basically as a catch-all. There wasn't any argument made that we got to connect these rules that he has allegedly broken. This means he is a danger because of this. That never even took place. All that the Court basically did was just throw it out and said, because I find he's a danger. And then the Court went into basically a rant where it kept referring back to all of his history. And that's the entire thing. If, let's say, the State is arguing that the Court cannot, once they say or they throw out that they say he is a danger, then they cannot consider a alternative, then I would put forth, then this Court should say then that it is unconstitutional. Because way back when the whole thing began in Carpenter, this Court said that it would only be constitutional if they were treated in the least restrictive setting. And that has to take place. That hasn't taken place. And there hasn't even been any attempt to take place
where,
in this case.
Where is, just cite me the case that says that they must be, that the Court has to place them in the least restrictive. It's the obligation.
No. What this Court said, I think this Court's exact language was in Carpenter, I think I cited it on my brief, I think this Court's exact language in Carpenter is that this Court said that something to the effect, or either these are the exact words, or the Court said something very much like this, that the statute was being held constitutional because the care and treatment of the subject was to be conducted in the least restrictive manner consistent with the requirements of the person.
Yes, and as I follow your argument and the questions that you've been posed to you, that your client is in a halfway less restrictive place, what is being brought before us and what you're saying is that his due process rights were violated because he wasn't given adequate notice of his, quote, alleged violations, the violations. Now, I'm reading from your brief and the appendix there, too, from pages 236, 237, 238, 239. This is the judge's discussion. He talks about this is not a criminal case. He says he's been convicted of crimes in the past, but he says he's been found to be suffering from a mental disorder. Then he says that, then he goes through, I'm talking about Judge Wilker, he goes through that he has been placed in the least restrictive situation that's consistent with his needs. And then, of course, the burden of proof is on the state. And then he goes through, in which you have provided us this part of the record, that he talks about his conduct, his deceitful course of conduct, his deviation, the alcohol, the so-called cigarette incident, the prescription for medicine, the instructions from his agent to be honest and open with him and before his so-called relationship with Miss Martin, Mrs. Martin. And this, well, I'm just asking you, you're saying that now this court, you're asking us to consider that this was a violation of due process, and I'm just asking you, and you said, well, Carpenter says, but I don't, is that your?
Yes. Your Honor, what this court, I mean, or, let's see, in, with all due respect, what you haven't grasped is this. There wasn't any consideration at that time to say what would be the least restrictive setting for him to have his treatment needs met. Basically, he went in and said, I have put him here. He has violated these rules.
And you're saying that the Carpenter case would lead us to the conclusion that the judge must consider alternatives.
Yes, because otherwise, what does it mean then? That means what really this court is really saying then is, like otherwise, is, well, basically, that's what we said at that time because it sounded nice and that would allow the statute to be upheld constitutionally at that time. But now, it doesn't really mean anything at all.
What would be wrong with just, say, if one were to read this and say, all right, Judge Wilker was the original judge. He then placed your client in a supervised setting, you know, in the halfway house. We had an option. He could have considered other alternatives. Now he is reviewing the case. He has that background, and he is citing the reasons why he doesn't want to place him back there because of, as he says in the last page, because of the consideration of extreme compulsive behavior, that given the fact that he was released under the conditions he had the strongest incentive to follow every rule. Now, and then he says on the next page, 242, that this is a high likelihood that his compulsive behavior will manifest itself in sexually violent behavior, which is harmful to the public in the future. So the judge is looking at these alleged violations and making a considered decision. And you're saying that no, he had to look at a least restrictive. He could not simply send him back to a confined setting.
Yes, and, Your Honor, I think, I mean, look at what he said. Basically, all that he said was, you know what, he violated rules. And then he basically throws in his history. And then as you just throughout, and he did it in loaded terms to say his extremely compulsive behavior and so on. But the fact is where was there any connection with what the guy did with that? There wasn't. No one ever took a step back and said, you know what, this is what he has actually done. What is a fair way to treat him and to treat him in a way that is the least restrictive fashion. That is what should have taken place. It never happened. No one even tried to do it. No one ever cared. And really, what is the history of this case?
Well, if I can just interrupt you for a minute. There are two provisions under the statute that pertain, Section 980.08, paren 6M, either of which would be sufficient for the court to make particular findings about what happens to happen next after the first finding. And one is a violation of the rules of supervised release or that his conduct impairs the safety of others. Essentially, that's what the statute looks at. So you could violate rules and the court might not determine that, in fact, the safety of others were at issue. If you had the former finding by the trial court that rules were violated without that being an impact on the safety of others, would there not be then a different analysis for the court to look at in regard to what to do next with your client?
Well, first, I put forth that this court should see that as being unconstitutional.
Why?
Because this court has said Chapter 980 is only constitutional because it had, because the treatment has to take place in the least restrictive setting.
Right, but that's,
you can't have it both ways.
You're saying, you're implying that that takes away any need to protect the public.
Not at all.
From someone
not at all.
Who is being treated. And my question to you goes back to what the legislature chose. They chose a bifurcated approach. First, the court has to make a determination, and after that determination is made, then the court has to decide what to do with the person whose revocation of supervised release the state is seeking. And my question to you again is, if the court had determined that there were simply rule violations without being concerned that the safety of others were impaired by this man's history and rule violations, would there be a different analysis about what to do with him next?
Well, I think then the case would be easier. But I also don't think that this court should basically overlook the fact is that this so-called finding that he was a danger is basically a throwaway statement. It's like throwaway comments. There was never an attempt to basically to tie up what he did to even say why that made him a danger. He didn't do anything that was even remotely
Counselor,
dangerous.
Counselor, you're not answering my question, and I'm
what?
Sorry
okay.
to be so persistent. I want to know if the trial court must make a different analysis of how to place this person depending on the first step in the process, whether the court finds simply rule violations or whether the court finds there is a danger to others.
Well, sure, because then that would be common sense. And I think that's the same thing that happens when one is revoked when they're on probation or parole. The first thing that you do is you basically sit down and you say, what did they do? And then after that, you take the next step. It says, what happens right now? And now, if somebody's getting revoked because they just have a couple minor violations, that's a very different situation versus someone getting revoked because they engaged in dangerous conduct. But one thing I will not concede is that he did not engage in dangerous conduct in this case. And it sins against the light. There's nothing there. What is being said here is, just if the judge decides on his own, he can just throw away everything that really happened and say, I say he is a danger, we will all say then he is a danger. And that is what has taken place in this case. There's nothing that he did that was dangerous. There's nothing that he did that was even remotely criminal, unless you're saying because he had sex with a woman that was married and so on and so on.
Why did he get a Viagra prescription?
Maybe he did it for a sex life, Judge. And I would put forth, maybe he did it for his sex life, and I would put forth, what's wrong with that? Especially, you know, it is sort of a mean, cruel joke. You make these guys, or not you, but I mean the state. The state makes these guys go through treatment after treatment after treatment after treatment. In the case at hand, he had come to his agent, I think it was a half dozen different times, and I asked the agent, could I have a normal relationship or start to talk to this woman? And he was turned down every time.
Summers, you imply that Mr. Burris has sexual dysfunction.
No, what I imply is that he's a normal human being who has been locked up for a long, long period of time. He's a normal human being that wants to have a normal, ordinary life, which would include, for most people, I think, an ordinary sex life. Even the judge said at the very end is, what would be good for Mr. Burris is if he could have a normal, ordinary relationship. Well, the fact of the matter was, they refused to allow him to do that. He tried that. And in the halfway house, every time he went and asked, and I talked to this woman, the agent said no. And so all that he did, basically, I guess, was he freelanced once on his own and tried to have a normal, ordinary relationship. And that's it. And to me, listen, Viagra is a legal drug. And even as the Chief Justice has pointed out, it is being shrilled for, or actually it was at one time, by Bob Dole. I don't think there's anything about that in itself that says this man is a criminal. This man is dangerous. This man has to be locked up. And that's what is being said. He has to be locked up now.
Why is it that Mr. Burris was unwilling to let his agent confer with his doctor as to the cause for granting the prescription?
First of all, is because he thought that he had a right not to do that. He thought he had the right to basically to have a privacy between him and his doctor. Number two, he also thought, and I think that the record is very clear, is that he thought that his agent had bad faith. And the agent's bad faith, actually, and that's why I put all that into my brief, is because that was the fact. It was the agent that was running around making up stories about him to try to get people to testify against him.
Let me ask you this. Is a person on supervised release after being found to be a sexually violent person subjectively able to determine what rules he or she is going to follow or not?
I see that my time is up, but I will respond by saying no. But I would say that's exactly why this court has to step in, and that's exactly why this court should step in. Because the way it is right now is it basically is if you put on supervised release, it is basically it is a nothing thing. And it can be arbitrarily yanked like that. And that is exactly why this court has to step in to make sure that when people are put into supervised release, that the rules are there for treatment and that the subjects get a fair shake. And so I would put forth, no, it isn't for Mr. Burris, but it is for this court.
Mr. Summers, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. I'm Mr. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'm going to start with the language of the revocation statute, 980.086M. Which provides that the court, after hearing, can revoke supervised release if it finds, by clear and convincing evidence, that any rule or condition of release has been violated or that the safety of others requires that supervised release be revoked. The theory of the state's, or the DHFS, is actually the person, the entity that moves to revoke, not the state, which is different than the prosecution of the case, but the theory that DHFS had in the trial court and which we took in the Court of Appeals was that the circuit court had found a number of rule violations and that was supported by clear and convincing evidence and that the court had correctly exercised its discretion in determining that Mr. Burris should be revoked. That exercise of discretion did not include, as far as I could tell from a reading of the court's oral decision from the bench, any notice, if you will, that the court considered alternatives to revocation. The Court of Appeals, in its decision, noted that in addition to the trial court's finding by clear and convincing evidence that there were rules violations, it also found that the safety of others required that supervised release be revoked. And I think if I read the Court of Appeals decision as I read the Court of Appeals decision, that was an alternative finding by the Circuit Court, or the Court of Appeals viewed it as that. Now, the Court of Appeals had delayed the decision in this case pending the Keating case, which is before this Court 2 terms ago, with the question of whether an alternatives of revocation needed to be considered by the trial court in arriving at revocation of supervised release. And when this Court split 3-3 on that question, the Court of Appeals issued its decision relying not on the rule violations, but on the safety of others finding. And I think it reasoned, and it makes perfect sense to me, that if the Court finds that the safety of others requires revocation by clear and convincing evidence, that it makes no sense to then proceed to say, in the exercise of my discretion, am I going to revoke this person?
Counsel, that's the very point that has been swimming around my mind, because I thought the Court of Appeals' opinion, and that you also endorse, that if the safety of other requires it, hey, there's no discretion here. It's required. It's mandated. Open, shut. Don't consider anything. You know, you've got to, go directly to go, And yet the problem is the legislature said something differently. And I don't know, the Court of Appeals opinion says, simply put, to say that you have any discretion is irrational. And I hate that the statute be considered irrational, so I want to see what we can do to save this thing.
Well,
the statute says, and I'm now referring now to 980.06.
0860?
60. That's what you're referring to. Okay, 60. Oh, you may be looking at the earlier statute. There are two statutes involved here, right? 95, 96, or 97, 98, and then 2001, 2002. And the earlier statute is 980.06-2D. The later statute is 980.086M, which is applicable.
In this case, it's the 06, but the language is identical in both.
Okay. So we should be referring to 980.06-2D.
That's correct.
Okay. And I know the language is identical. The language of the statute says, if the court determines after hearing that the safety of other require that supervised release be revoked. Boy, if I were a circuit court judge and made that finding, as I said, bingo, bango, bongo, it'd be done. But the legislature says, then the court may revoke. Isn't that irrational?
If you don't consider the whole couple of sentences there, one could reach that conclusion.
But I don't mean to be unfair. I mean, what sentences?
Well, I think
I
you have to read it as the legislature put two separate proceedings in the same sentence. And if you read the may, which is the word that causes the problem, it may revoke, in connection with the rule violations, then it makes perfect sense because that's the procedure that Morrissey seems to require.
Counsel, that's not the way it's written, though.
Well, I think it is, because the word requires refers only to the safety of others.
Well, okay, let's read it the way you want to. The state has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that any rule or condition of release has been violated. I'm sorry, the next, if the court determines that any rule or condition of release has been violated, it may revoke the order for supervised release. That's
right.
The way you want to do. Okay, now we read the second part. If the court determines that the safety of others requires that supervised release be revoked,
then I think you have to read may as meaning must. It must revoke.
You want us to put in the words must be revoked.
Right, but and
order that the released person be appropriate.
Well, I would contend that must is one of the acceptable meanings of may. The problem is that we have two alternative thoughts going on in the same sentence. Now, if we had set these out in separate sentences, it would certainly be very apparent that either shall or must would have been the word instead of may. But I think it's you can fairly read the term may to mean must, and certainly the term requires seems to me to be a more specific term, which should override a discretionary term may. And this Court has interpreted may.
Why don't you just say, hey, there's a problem with the wording of the statute, and let's take care of it? I mean, why should we say, well, may should mean must here, and requires, although they said requires might mean may. I mean, we got a problem with the wording of the statute, so let's just address it. How should we address it?
But if you read it the way you suggest, which is it always means may, then what on earth does the circuit court do when it does make a finding that the safety of others requires revocation? And let's suppose
That's
there's no
point.
Rule violation.
That's my point. We got a problem. You know, it's not like this is awful or the end of the world. I mean, how should we address a problem that conceptually says the safety requires this, and the statute then says may? If you really were going to say, well, the statute, the may means must, I mean, well, that's a little artificial and disingenuous.
It may be, but I think it's less artificial than reading the safety of others out of the statute entirely.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying we've got a problem. So what's your best solution on what we do with this word, these words?
My best solution is you read it may when it deals with the rule violations. You read it must when it deals with the safety of others. But if you want to say the court has to exercise discretion, but that discretion is a foregone conclusion because of its findings based on clear and convincing evidence, that's fine with me.
Counselor, I have another suggestion for you that occurs to me, and I don't know what you think of it, so I would like to hear about it. You know, when people are out on supervised release, they're out on various plans. They don't all live in the same kind of halfway house that the person we're speaking about here today lived in. Sometimes they're quite restrictive. Sometimes the restrictions are such in a halfway house that the person really is watched 24/7, and it's possible that putting someone in an institution, though may physically remove him from the particular community that he currently is in, doesn't really change how closely he's watched and how carefully he's watched. And I was trying to get to some of that with opposing counsel about, depending on what finding the court makes, whether it's simply a rule violation or the safety of others requires revocation, that the court may determine that putting him outside of his current placement doesn't actually change his day-to-day living or the public's protection. What do you think about that?
Well, if we're talking about a rule violation, I think that analysis that you just set forth would be part of the exercise of discretion in determining whether or not, given these rule violations and the
Let's
safety
talk about
of,
the other part, because
right.
the other part is more problematic.
The other aspect, it seems to me, is that if what we're proceeding under is whether the safety of others requires supervised release to be revoked,
right.
then the question is, given all of those circumstances, does clear and convincing evidence really require establish that revocation is required? And certainly, if in fact, as you set up that hypothetical, one would have no greater control over this individual in an institution than in the supervised release placement, I would say that that's a pretty tough burden to overcome by clear and convincing evidence that the safety of others, especially without a rule violation, would
require
revocation.
I see. So you don't think you could find the safety of others requires if, in fact, revocation was unnecessary because the terms of placement would be pretty much the same?
I think that would be fair, okay. And not only that, but if you didn't have a rule violation, the state would be obliged to do that to a heightened burden. I mean, once
you pretty much assume you're going to have a rule violation or you don't get into these. The question is it significant enough to revoke them or not?
No, I don't assume that. And the reason I don't assume it is that I can well envision a situation where during treatment things happen that lead the treatment professionals to conclude that somebody's mental condition has so deteriorated that they need to be taken off supervised release and there is no rule violation.
Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Okay, so that's the concern. And I think that's what this section really is aimed at. If we have a rule violation, which we did in this case, there really wasn't any need to go down the safety of others road. But that's what the Court of Appeals did, and it seems to me once they did that, I have an obligation to assess to this Court whether that makes any sense, and I think it does, in at least in that kind of situation.
I'm going to approach Justice Rogan-Sack's question in a slightly different context, but I think it comes out the same. What alternatives are available other than supervised release or an appropriate institution?
Well, in terms of the status, which is the way I like to think of these, there's the status of institutional placement and there's the status of supervised release.
Okay.
And in terms of the status, there's only the two. But within supervised release,
okay,
and perhaps someday, and actually now, but within the status of the institution also, there are different levels and different placements. So, for instance...
Okay, but let's just... I accept that.
Okay.
As to the different levels of supervised release, who determines what that level is? Is it the department with the court? And the same question goes with institutionalization.
Well,
I don't think that the court determines what the appropriate institution is because it just goes back to the department.
That's
right?
Certainly the way the language that applied to Mr. Burris read, because it's the early language. And the early language said the department shall place the person in the least restrictive setting consistent with the court's order. And I would assume that means if the court orders it on orders supervised release, then it's up to the department to determine what placement within supervised release is appropriate for this particular individual.
That's
the 06 language. Now that's since been removed in the 1999 amendments. But ultimately, I think it is kind of a joint decision. And the reason is that the court has an approval of the supervised release plan.
Okay. Then that goes back to my ultimate question on the statute. Because if the court determines that supervised release be revoked, that means all levels of supervised release. Or does it mean just this level of supervised release?
I think it means all level.
Okay. So what your position then is, if I understand it, if there's a finding that safety of others requires that supervised release be revoked, it's mandatory that supervised release be revoked, not move it up to another level.
That's right.
And your position is that if the court, by clear and convincing evidence, is persuaded that a rule or condition has been violated, the court may revoke supervisory.
That's right. And in that,
and may not, and if it will, it might move it up to a higher level or a lower level, whatever.
Yes.
But if it finds safety, it must revoke. And if it revokes, you go into an institution.
That's right. And I think the safeguard for that view is that it has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. So if the court finds that the safety of others, now not an other, it's plural, so I think it kind of means the general public safety here. If the public safety is sufficiently at risk because of this person's mental condition, deterioration, whatever, then it revokes the supervised release, and judicial review is premised on whether or not the evidence establishes by clear and convincing evidence that that was necessary. Now, in a manner of speaking, that is an alternative to revocation in the sense that if there's a reasonable alternative that the court could have taken, short of sending the person back to the institution, and there's no evidence of a rule violation, it seems to me that, I now have a pretty tough argument that the evidence establishes by clear and convincing evidence that revocation was required.
Under the safety provision.
Under the safety provision. Right. Now, if there's a rule violation, then there's more wiggle room for the court, and consequently, once the decision is made for me, because we're talking about only the violation needs to be established by clear and convincing evidence, whether or not to revoke becomes a discretionary decision by the court. And I think maybe that's a good thing. I don't think we want the department to be able to come in and say, well, we've got these medicals that maybe show he's a little worse and maybe not. We want to revoke supervised release. Well, we got a more heightened burden here, and that's probably not going to make it.
With all due respect, Mr. Weinstein, it is the 2001-2002 statutes that has the language the department shall arrange for control and care. I can't find that in the 1999 statute.
It's in 06 sub. I don't
know. 2D. I'm sorry. 1906. Yeah, where is it?
It's at the end of 06.
2D.
Current statutes.
Okay. I'll
it says, after all of the business about placing the person on supervised release, the paragraph that starts out, an order for supervised release places the person.
I'll look for it. It's not in 2D, but I'll look for it.
Counsel, I have another question. I can see where a rule violation would be a finding of fact. The statute says if the trial court determines, so it doesn't tell us what it expects us to do. Is the standard the safety of others requires a legal standard, so it's a conclusion of law, or is it also a factual finding in your view?
I would think it's a factual finding because, again, the level, the burdens of proof that we talk about a couple of things in terms of burden of proof, but when we're talking about beyond a reasonable doubt and clear and convincing, what we're really talking about is how persuasive is the evidence, which means, in my view, those things apply to factual findings. So then the standard of review on appeal is somewhat different because that presents a legal question of whether or not it was reasonable for the finder of fact to reach that particular determination to the requisite level of proof.
Okay.
So I would say that in the context of this statute, that finding that the safety of others requires supervised release be revoked is a finding of fact.
So they're both the same. Do you equate them both the same way?
Well, in terms of the heightened burden and whether or not they're findings of fact, yes.
Thank you.
Could I ask you to discuss the relationship between alternatives to revocation and least restrictive requirement?
Well, the in terms of the statutory provision or in terms of a claim that alternatives of are least restrictive is somehow constitutionally required, which is an argument that's been floating around. And I don't think there's any decision on it.
Alternatives to revocation strike me as not really in the statute. They're brought in from outside. But least restrictive requirement is in 5161
right.
And elsewhere in 980.
Right. That's right. In my view, the least restrictive requirement, which speaks to the department, is that if the person can be safely treated and supervised with a certain level of restraint, then a more onerous level of restraint should not be I hesitate to use the word prohibited, but because of things that might occur in the future. But for now, it would be prohibited. So if you could safely treat somebody in a sheltered living condition, safely treat them, reasonably ensure the safety of the public in that, then a halfway house would be an inappropriate placement. Alternatives to revocation, it seems to me, is speaks to when this person has violated a condition or a rule of the supervised release, and we know that that indicates a problem. Are there any reasonable alternatives short of institutionalization that would safely protect the public and allow treatment of this person? Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with the court considering that. The problem with that, at least if we look at the model of probation and parole, is that it ends up becoming a sticking point because the record doesn't reflect it, or is the court required to take an alternative if there is one, but the court thinks it's not the appropriate one, and all of these, this kind of tangential litigation that ends up surrounding parole and probation revocations. And as I read the case law currently, that alternatives is not constitutionally mandated. And as I read Plotkin, this court adopted it for parole as a matter of administrative policy. And even the court, the judiciary, has never adopted it in a probation setting. The department adopted some rules, and I think, I'm not sure why, but if I were to guess, I would guess that it was because for ease of administration, treating parole and probation the same, it makes sense to have the same rules for both, and so they adopted a rule that did that. And this court acknowledged that it was okay in Van Erman. But there's no decision from this court or the United States Supreme Court that says due process requires this, and I don't find anything in this statute that indicates that it should be considered. Now, you could impose it as a policy like they did in Plotkin, but I don't think, given this particular subset of people, it's a good idea.
That would only apply in a rules violation because that's where there's discretion.
That's right.
Doesn't apply in safety.
If you agree with the Court of Appeal that the way this works is that when the department demonstrates by clear and convincing evidence that a person's safety, that the public's safety requires revocation of supervised release, then there would be no discretion, and in my view, the alternatives of revocation are part of the discretionary decision, so that would just be automatic and we wouldn't worry about it. If it's a rule violation, then if you want to impose it, that's where it would come in.
There is a rule that was imposed on Mr. Burris. You shall pay all court-ordered financial obligations and treatment co-payments as directed by your agent. Suppose that was the only rule he violated. Do you have to consider, as a matter of law, alternatives to revocation?
Well, I suppose if it's part of due process, you would. But it seems to me that it wouldn't make any sense to consider it in that situation. In fact, I would think I would have a fairly difficult, if the person's supervised release was revoked for that and that was the only problem, it seems to me that that would be a tough discretionary decision to uphold. And I think that's one of the problems that this alternatives to revocation causes. I mean, because sometimes it makes sense in the context of the rules, and sometimes it doesn't.
Could I ask once more, and maybe you answered this. The circuit judge is sitting, and he sees or she sees 5161 and other references to least restrictive requirement. Is it the responsibility of the judge to try to implement that language, or is that solely the responsibility of the department?
The way that the language of the statute originally was, I think it is solely the responsibility of DHFS. But as I indicated before, because the court, and now this is in the initial supervised release placement, not so much in a revocation proceeding, because in a revocation proceeding, everything is before the court. But in the initial placement, the court does have a role in approving the supervised release plan. So I think a court could reasonably say, look, I don't think you've taken the most least restrictive path here, and therefore I'm not going to approve the supervised release plan. And that may well be an appropriate exercise of discretion. But the statute does not specifically say to the court, you have to consider the least restrictive placement. That's really the department's function.
Is that in the original placement that you're talking about now?
That's the original supervised release.
Okay, but in revocation, court finds safety, if I understand Justice Prosser's question, the court finds that safety requires revocation. And you say they have to then revoke.
Right.
Where does least restrictive placement come into play?
Well, in that case, then, the least restrictive
institutionalized.
Secure mental health institution.
The department.
But where does it come in the decision? I would say that if there is a reasonable, less restrictive placement than institutional placement, then the question is whether or not the evidence in fact establishes by clear and convincing evidence that revocation was required.
So your position is that if the person, say, is in the least restrictive halfway house, safety requires that he be moved from there to a more restrictive halfway house, but doesn't require that he be institutionalized, then you would not, the court would not revoke probation, but would order the department to place the person in a more restrictive halfway house under supervised release. That's
your position? In effect, yes. How that's done might be problematic because I'm not sure the court has the authority to specify a certain thing, but by a certain placement. But by saying here are the additional conditions, I'm not going to revoke, but what I am going to do is impose additional conditions on the supervised release and fashion those so that they can only be met by putting this person in the placement that you suggest.
So
I think that's
really
the way it ought to work.
May means may. If there's a safety problem, the court need not revoke supervised release, but may just increase the supervised release.
Well, but see, then I think what the court is doing is not exercising discretion. It's finding that the evidence does not establish by clear and convincing evidence that revocation is required.
It seems to me, in order to determine that the safety of the public requires revocation, one just necessarily is ruling out options.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think that's what motivated the Court of Appeals to say that it was irrational to say that you've made that finding, but you also have to consider alternatives to revocation.
So you're reading the statute that requires revocation of this supervised release.
That's right.
This type of supervised release.
That's right. And, of course, the person within a year can apply again, and that's a whole new proceeding.
I want to, even if your red light is on, raise a basic issue in this case, which is rule number one. And when exactly did Mr. Burris get notice of violations in the halfway house and alcohol abuse?
I think it was 2 weeks or so before the hearing.
Is there anything in the record that shows that? I know that there's...
It's in the Court of Appeals decision. When this case was...
No, but is there anything in the record that supports the Court of Appeals decision?
Yes, there is.
When
this case was briefed before the Court of Appeals, that issue was separately argued and pressed by both parties, and the court addressed it separately. And I didn't view it as being raised because it wasn't either advanced in the petition or separately briefed here. But I do think that the evidence recited by the Court of Appeals indicating the... Now, this is on the notification of the alcohol and by the way, the circuit court ever really found as a violation of rules that the halfway house rules counted. What it did was it said the violation of the halfway house rules indicates why the other rule violations warrant revocation. But in terms of that alcohol specifically, the Court of Appeals decision, which indicates when the information was provided, and it was also one of the other allegations was the name of the woman who he was alleged to have a sexual liaison with. And both of those were provided prior to the hearing, and the Court of Appeals says that. Now, in terms of the vagueness argument, that the Court of Appeals said, well, you're not entitled to raise it except for as it affects you, and you should have known it because Viagra.
Is that a standard rule, number one, in sexual offender cases?
I'm sorry.
Is rule number one usually appear in the...
Based on the number of that I have seen, yes, it's just like pretty much just like probation and parole. That's pretty much the standard first rule.
All right, thank you, Mr. Summers. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
A couple of quick points. First, in regards to the allegation of the alcohol, actually that was raised in the petition for review by Mr. Burris. We went into it in detail, and if this court directed this court's attention to page 4, actually there we pointed out, and I believe this is the correct record, the first time that Mr. Burris received notice in regards to the alcohol violation was the day prior to the hearing. So that's what actually happened. He received it the day prior. Also, in regards to that, of course, I think this court is aware, the only evidence against him was basically a Mr. Crawford, who basically entered a plea deal with the state to testify against Mr. Burris, and his testimony contradicted basically the testimony of the staff of the halfway house and the fact that Mr. Burris had passed every single UA. In regards to what is irrational is for a court to make a finding that that the safety of others requires that supervised release be revoked without first considering whether or not things can be put in place to make sure that the person can be treated without being basically put into what is a prison but by a different name. And also in this case, I think one thing this court has to keep in mind is that there has to be some reasoned discussion by the judge to why the safety of others requires that the subject be, that his supervised release be revoked. Otherwise, you will have what has happened in this case happen all of the time. All that the judge basically said is he has violated some rules because of his history. That means he is a danger. And otherwise, I mean, that is just going to be a catch-all. And unless the court is forced to articulate or explain the connection, or let's say the facts that show that he is a danger, that will always be a
catch-all, and people like Mr. Burris or men like Mr. Burris will always just be locked up.
Thank you, Mr. Summers, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for...
Justice Prosser. On December 30th, there was an amended statement of probable cause that alluded to alcohol violations. The record indicates that that wasn't filed with the court until January 8th, the day of the hearing.
Right. And the I believe the trial attorney testified at the hearing we had after that. He didn't receive it until January 7th is the first time that was ever that notice was ever passed on to Mr. Burris's attorney.
That's in the record?
I believe that's the trial attorney testified. This hearing was about it's quite a long time ago, but I believe that that's what the testimony was. I believe that they claim later on they brought the agent on and said that he had somehow faxed it over at some time. But I believe that the trial attorney's testimony is that he had received it. That's why he drafted a hearing. I mean, he drafted a motion right prior to that hearing, basically alleging that he had not received notice and that should be kept out. And so I believe it was the trial attorney's contention that he did not receive notice until the day prior.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing in 01-2461 in May commitments of State v. Morford and Burris. And we will this afternoon hear State v. Morford. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. See you later, Mr. Weinstein. Thank you.